Coming up on Boston Public Radio, now there are two, and we'll be joined by at least one of the men who would be Boston's next mayor. Then we'll be joined by people who've covered this race from stem to stern. Why it happened, what the results mean in a majority-minority city. Will the final be all about unions and much more? Then Globe editor Brian McGorry gives us his sense of the final field, talks about Pope Francis, and whether he is turning the corner on urban cycling, Marjorie.
And then between 1 and 2, the governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, is with us. He's going to take our questions, and he's going to take yours. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's all over.
Well, it's not over. It's just beginning. And this is what
That's a good point, actually. We don't have a new mayor yet, do we?
Here's what victory sounds
Thank
like.
Thank you, Jim.
This campaign is the face of Boston, and we are working together for each other and for Boston's future. I thank you so much. Let's go win this campaign. Thank you.
More opportunity for equality and community. These are my values. These are your values. These are Boston's values. Thank you.
Those were the winners of last night's mayoral preliminary. A headline on UniversalHub.com heralded these victories this way: Boston to get first Irish-American mayor in 20 years. It's Marty Walsh and John Connolly the winners. It's easy to get hung up on symbolism. It's all for the campaign talk of moving the city forward. It looks like Boston is stuck, well, some would say, in old ways. Some would say not at all. Joining us to sort through the election results are GBH's Peter Kadzis, Kelly Crossley, and Adam Riley. Good to see all three of you.
Hey, guys.
Hey. So, guys, as Jim just pointed out, it's not actually all over, as I said, because we haven't yet elected the next mayor of the city of Boston. So, who's it going to be?
Oh, it's these two guys are neck and neck. You can't say who it's going to be.
You can't say who it's going to be?
No, and also, we have to fill these airwaves for six more weeks, so give us a little time.
Very fine point,
but,
Peter.
But this is in cultural terms, though. This is a race between Dorchester and West Roxbury, the two most politicized parts of the city. Dorchester is multi-ethnic, multicultural. West Roxbury is largely lily white, upper middle class, middle class. There's two versions of Boston in some way.
The Shamrocks on the shutters in West Roxbury.
Well, the Shamrocks everywhere.
Just to jump in on Peter's comment, though, I think it's important to note that John Connolly is not casting himself as a candidate who wants to appeal to, you know, white Irish people in West Roxbury.
Neither one of them are.
Right, no, exactly. So I'm just saying when Peter...
No, these are the vote. You're yes. Very good point, and you're right to bring me up short there. This is the way the constituents
yes.
see themselves. The candidates don't. The candidates are delightfully above it all.
So, Kelly Crossley, what's your takeaway from last night at about 10 o'clock?
Well, as Peter and I discussed, I think it's interesting, two things. The Herald's opening line in the editorial this morning says there's a reason they call it conventional wisdom because this is what happens. On the other hand, it may look like the duck, but I think it might be something else going on here.
What's the something else?
And that is that it's in my conversation with Peter before, it's about neighborhood, as he said, but it's really about the city as well. And you haven't heard people articulate that in the way that these two have. Some people can say it's disingenuous. I don't think it is. I think they recognize we're in a different time and space, and so their neighborhood really has to be the city of Boston.
My guess is this is the longest conversation between now and November 5th in which the word union does not come up. So, Peter Kadzis, every single pollster had it right on with one exception. The one outlier who they didn't have close to right was the guy who ended up number one. They had him 11, 12, whatever. He gets a lot more than that, comes in one, Marty Walsh. I think it proves what I was a skeptic about yesterday, about his 2,000 volunteers. Labor, which has come up short on a whole lot of fronts on recent elections. I mean, Steve Tolman, the head of the AFL-CIO last night, sounded like his head was going to pop off his shoulders. He was so excited. Organized labor essentially made Marty Walsh number one, didn't they?
No doubt about it. The number's not 2,000 volunteers. It was 1,700. they're rounding up. But no, this is a big victory for organized labor. I wonder, and I'm underlining and italicizing the word wonder, if the sort of progressive surge we saw in the nation saw in New York City in its Democratic primary is being mirrored here with the rise of the labor again. Labor cuts both ways, though.
Of course it
does.
But,
you know, one thing about labor, though, it seems to me that the unions that people are hostile toward are the public employee unions, not so much the iron workers or the electricians.
No, it's the unions that represent the same guys that we lionize when they respond to a disaster. And we
exactly, Adam.
But thank you. But he's been most associated, that is Marty Walsh, with the building trades. I don't think there's the same kind hostility
but
there.
But here's how this could come in. Listen, Roxbury is going to be key in this election. You know, the biggest issues facing the city, who's going to be the new superintendent of schools, who's going to be the new police commissioner, who's going to develop 60% of the developable land in Boston, which is in Roxbury. These are all, you know, as we say today, majority-minority issues. And the unions, the trade unions, may have all these programs to bring minority workers in, but not many of the minority workers get to stick. So this union thing is really tricky on a number of levels.
That was Walsh's big thing, was to tout his push to do that. So that makes him more interesting in some of those quarters you've just named.
The argument that you're going to hear, the way that the public employee unions are going to come in, the public safety unions are going to come in, and I was hearing this argument yesterday at Connolly's election night party from his supporters, what they're going to say is if Marty Walsh has relied on the help of all the unions to put him in the mayor's office in City Hall, how is he going to be able to stand down and negotiate with them in a way that's tough? And of course, Marty Walsh's argument, you know, he says essentially, I'm going to be able to negotiate with these people because they know that
me, I'm going to give them a fair shake is the bottom line. But that's a slightly nuanced issue. And I think I hearken back to the Herald editorial, the Connolly and Connolly editorial. They took the unusual step in the second to last paragraph saying anybody but Marty Walsh and sort of doing the broad brush thing about unions. You know, Kelly Crossley, Marjorie Egan jokes all the time, only half joking, that every time a Democrat runs for office, first thing they say is how their mother was a washerwoman. They lived in a 14-story walk-up in Dorchester. I'll give you a little hint. We talked to Marty Walsh earlier this morning. We're going to play it in a couple of minutes. And he acknowledged that there's a lot of similarity between the two of them on the issues. It seems to me a major division. One guy comes from a really prominent political family, Connolly, went to Harvard, all that sort of stuff. And Marty Walsh talks about his father being a laborer. He said it last night. And all these, that's going to matter here, where they came from. That's going to be a major part of the campaign, do you not think?
It depends. You know, now I always hearken back to John Edwards, pre all of the drama. But at the beginning, what John Edwards said was, I came from nothing. And I made a lot of money and I got a lot of money. But guess what? I know there's two Americas. That really resonated with people for someone who had all of the experiences. I think it's how you characterize yourself. I think it's what you put out there in terms of your relatability to people's issues and understanding where they are. It's a long way from being the first Bush and not understanding the grocery store register. Understanding people's lives.
Peter Kadzis looks like he's going to have his corpuscles bounce out of his head.
No. Listen, the Walsh family is one half a generation behind the Connollys in terms of social advancement. But his father set him up in the union, got him into union management. It's a different sort of privilege, but Walsh is from blue collar privilege, not white collar privilege. But there's privilege there nonetheless.
How does he separate? I mean, assuming that there is similarity between the issues, one of the obviously he's going to talk, I have a different experience. I got to vote on these things as opposed to, you know, Connolly being in a different position. How do they distinguish themselves if there's a lot of overlap on substance?
Well, one other biographical piece that we haven't brought up, and I don't know how it's going to play out in the campaign, is Walsh's connection to what he calls the recovery community, which I think people, you know, some people have speculated that's going to be an asset for him in the campaign. I actually think it's going to be kind of interesting to see how he references or his supporters reference the fact that he's a recovering alcoholic. I mean,
and by the way, he was not outed. He went to Yvonne Abraham in the Globe a handful of months ago, had her do a piece in one of his early ads in
this
campaign.
It was a really good column.
He mentions that, so he has been really upfront with this in this campaign.
It cuts both ways, though, don't you think?
It does cut both ways, and I'm interested to see. I don't know if we're going to get any sort of, you know, suggestions that that is a liability rather than an asset from Connolly or his surrogates. I would, you know, not from John Connolly, but from people connected to his campaign. And I wonder how much Marty Walsh is going to bring it up. But there's also the question of how aggressive they are talking about reform in the Boston public schools. I mean, I think, Peter, I remember you and I were on air sometime recently, and I made a reference to John Connolly being anti-teachers union. And you said, well, he wouldn't identify himself that way. And you're exactly right. He wouldn't. But Connolly, I think, is going to make it clear that he would ask for bigger concessions from the teachers union and more radical change in the schools than Marty Walsh.
See, I think it's the responsibility of the press, of us, to focus this rather sprawling education debate. You know, one of the issues is more freedom for principals to act, freedom to act. No one's talking about core curriculums or how we teach writing. And I don't know, maybe this is my own little...
Or how you pay for it.
I don't think we teach it anymore, do we?
But I think we in the press have an obligation to really try to focus the education debate.
Yeah, we're talking to Peter Kadzis, Kelly Crossley, and Adam Riley, all three of whom have been all over this campaign with whatever 6 weeks to go. The person who came in third last night, Charlotte Goler-Ritchie, said this memorable line in the middle of her concession speech last night.
We opened the door. Yes. Yes. We opened the door. And somebody else is going to have to walk through it, right? We didn't get to walk through it. But somebody else will.
Kelly Crossley, starting with you, and then we'll get to the other two. Did she open the door, or is this a rather disappointing morning in a majority-minority city when the leading candidate of color came in third place?
Well, I think it's a disappointing morning for a couple of reasons. 4 percentage points is a tiny amount of percentage points. And this, you know, nobody, even Marty Walsh, didn't top out at, you know, 40%.
19%.
So, you know, so you got it. You see that opportunity there and you see it just flying by. And a scenario where there were certainly the numbers, not just in neighborhoods where it would be assumed that she would draw some, even if she didn't draw everybody, but also across the city. I mean, she came into the race with a broad base of support. That was supposed to be her strength. And then she should be able to keep her base as well. That is the principle upon which a President Obama has won both times. I go out and broaden my base, and then I hang on to the core that everybody assumes I'd get, and I make sure that I bring them in too. So not to have done that, yes, that is a disappointment.
I want to question notion that Charlotte Goler-Ritchie put forward in that bite we heard, that she opened the door. Didn't Mel King open the door in 1983?
30 years ago.
Or couldn't you say
that? Got 48,000 votes as compared to roughly 15, 30 years later, you know, for the leading candidate of color.
And to cast her as a door opener, I mean, I get that she's talking about a municipal race, but since then, you know, America's elected a black president. We've elected a black governor a couple times here in Massachusetts. I want to push back at the idea that in some way communities of color or the Boston electorate somehow let us down by failing to, and I'm not saying this is your idea, but I think, Callie, but I think this idea is sort of out there in the ether today that, oh, you know, it's a sad thing Boston's still not ready to elect.
Well, I'm not
talking
about letting us down, but let me just say, I've cited this statistic repeatedly that I got in the New York Times the other day. There are two northern cities in the United States that have not elected a mayor of color. One is Indianapolis and one is Boston. We're a majority-minority city.
Okay, let me just say this. If Charlotte Goler-Ritchie, I saw her get better over the course of this campaign, and there's much to recommend her, but her campaign, I think it's fair to say, was not a well-oiled machine. If she had been a stronger candidate from the get-go, if her campaign had been, I think, better run, she would have had a spot.
She, also started very late. She didn't have the ground.
And she's been out of public life.
Let me put this in perspective for you all.
Go ahead, Peter.
What's important here is that Gola Ritchie was able to salvage her dignity. She did it very effectively by coming on strong at the end. And Boston is a better place for her strong finish.
Who's going to remember that
Friday? Hold on. The other thing is, no one denied her the position. There were no racist attacks on her. You know, no. She lost. She didn't win fair and square. In terms of the air we breathe, I think that's important.
And also, I'm sorry to be all hot and bothered about this. I'll pipe down in a minute. But let's not point the finger at John Barrows and say, oh, well, if he hadn't run, if he hadn't been a spoiler, she would have been in there. I'll tell you this. Philip Martin, our colleague here at WGBH, got some sound from a woman that he used on air this morning on WGBH who was saying, well, this isn't the way we're supposed to do it. We're not supposed to have a bunch of candidates.
You don't have to go to Philip Martin's report. A number of people who were supporters of Charlotte Gola Ritchie earlier in the campaign, even though she denied any involvement in this, were troubled by the fact that there was an inability to rally around a candidate, in particular
And I think that is deeply bogus. For one thing, it suggests that any candidate of color, that all candidates of color are the same and that the best one, the top one, should get out of the way for the others. John Barrows' background, ethnically and racially, is not the same as Charlotte Gola Ritchie's. And in addition, John Barrows was a really good candidate who opened a lot of people's eyes. There's absolutely no reason to suggest that he should have gotten out of the way so that she could get a spot in the final. And I think it's patronizing to suggest otherwise.
No, it is. But I wonder if we in the press are obsessing about this.
What do you mean? How can we not? Well, we'll talk about it in a couple of seconds. Okay.
You know, we talked earlier this morning with the guy who did come in first place last night. That would be State Representative Marty Walsh. When we come back, we're going to hear what he had to say. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
A college diploma is still the key to getting ahead. Yet paying for college education is more challenging than ever.
Coming up with $600 extra is just another struggle. It makes it hard because you lose focus when it comes to education when you have to come up to pay the bills.
Voices of students and administrators, faculty and staff from WGBH's Higher Ed Desk on campus on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you. An Innuendo Natick featuring Hunter Douglas window fashions for controlling light and glare. Innuendo staff can help you select the right Hunter Douglas products and offers full measuring and installation services. Innuendo.com. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Joining us on the phone is one of the two men with a chance to be called mayor-elect on November 6th, State Representative Marty Walsh. Congratulations and welcome.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you very much for having me today.
Yeah, congratulations to Marty. So I'm wondering, before the polls closed at 8 o'clock last night, did you have the concession speech ready and the victory speech, or were you just really sure you were going to make it to the top?
To be honest with you, I had a victory speech ready. And if it was a concession speech, I knew what I was going to say to all my friends and supporters and families and the other candidates. So it would have been a different speech, obviously, and I would have just done it off the cuff.
Marty, you told us yesterday, we discussed with you when you called in, that when you were elected state rep in the 90s, you were so, I don't even know what the word is, so overwhelmed that you drove to the state house late at night and just stared at the thing. What'd you do last night after the lights went off and the microphones were turned off?
When I got home last night at, I think it was 11:30, after being in the party and then going up to the holding room with all the consultants, if you will, I went home and I sat in my front porch and I called the people that I called in the very beginning. Not everybody, but a lot of them, and thanked them for their faith in me and their support, because they were in the crowd yesterday, and if it weren't for them, I certainly would have not have had the victory that I had yesterday.
Well, you couldn't have driven down to City Hall, Marty Walsh, because you want to tear it down, right?
I'm not driving there right now. I'm gonna wait. That might happen November 5th, but it didn't happen last night, because I still have 6 weeks to go.
So let me ask you, Marty Walsh, you know, when people say John Connolly, the guy that's going to run against you, they say schools. Marty Walsh, unions, unions, unions. I mean, that's not the platform, obviously. So what are the big differences between you and Connolly for people that are just focusing on this right now?
I mean, my campaign has been focused on all the issues. We're not just focused on one issue. We're focused on more than one issue and, you know, also focusing on working families and making sure that we continue to move Boston forward. When it comes to education, though, when John talks about schools, that's an important discussion here in the city of Boston. But of all the candidates, but now it's just the two of us, I'm the only one of the two of us that actually had a vote on education reform. And I was proud to vote for education reform to make some changes in the collective bargaining agreement. Also, I'm a founding board member of a charter school. I've been a board member for a charter school for over 17 years. So when you talk about reform in education, I'm the one that has the credentials here. I'm the one that has a record of accomplishment in actually making changes to turn those schools in Boston around. And we're going to talk about in the campaign, but we're also talking about economic development. We're talking about, you know, an issue in this campaign that kind of rose to the top a little bit. It was poverty. When we talk about, you know, improving our schools, we have to help people out of poverty. When we talk about reducing crime, we have to talk about getting people out of poverty. When we talk about economic development, we have to get people out of poverty. And that's the common theme here. And we've talked about it for the last 6 weeks, or the last 4 months, I should say. You know, as far as unions go, listen, I'm proud to be a supporter of labor and working people. However, you know, my campaign, we're talking about the issues, and it certainly, I hope, resonated with the people of Boston enough to give me a victory last night, and I'm proud of that.
But, Marty Walsh, this is not exactly correct, but pretty close. The pollsters had this race almost exactly right for 11 of the 12 candidates. The one they were way off on was you, and my take from the outside is what they didn't see is the ability of organized labor to do what you said you were going to do, is get out the vote big time. The reason you came in number one last night, in great part, is because of the work and support of organized labor, no?
No, that was a part of it, but I had 1,500 volunteers that were not part of labor. 1,500 people that have been volunteering on my campaign, working, going door to door. I mean, you don't get a vote like that by pulling. You have to identify the vote. You have to have the relationships. You have to do the work before so you can pull the vote out. And my campaign has been constantly doing that. We knocked 300,000 doors. People were saying to my volunteers, we're sick of you coming to our door. We were there 3 and 4 times, and which is fine. You know, and some people, you know, tweeted yesterday, we're not voting for you because so many people are knocking at the doors. But that's what you have to do in an election.
Hey, Marty Walsh, what's that? You mentioned a minute ago the experience factor, for example, on education. John Connolly is using his education card, and you're saying, yeah, but I've done it on on the board of a charter school, and the thing you said about voting on education reform. Is it fair to say, though, that other than very different experiences and personal background, family, that sort of thing, that you guys are pretty similar? You're pretty much in the same place on most of the issues. Is that not a fair statement?
I mean, I think we're similar in a lot, certainly in a lot of the issues. I mean, we're gonna find out probably some differences over the course of the next 6 weeks. But there's a lot of things that we spoke about. I mean, we're both in favor of the East Boston only vote for the folks in East Boston on the casino. That's one issue that we're both the same on. There are some other similarities here. But, you know, the difference is values versus education, and I think that's important. You know, I talked last night about values, and I talked about the importance of representing all of Boston, every neighborhood in Boston. And I think that that's what this race is going to come down to. Several people have brought up to me today, as a matter of fact, reporters about, you know, nobody of color got into the final, and how are you going to represent the communities of color? And it comes down to, you know, it comes down to that values versus education statement. My district is 56% people of color. I've worked when I was the head of the building trades. I created a program called Building Pathways to give people and women of color the opportunity to get into the building trades. That's a small taste of what people are going to see out of my administration and my campaign. We're going to continue to work. We're going to work in every neighborhood. We were in every neighborhood yesterday. And that's I'm going to separate myself in this race as we talk about the issues.
We're talking with Marty Walsh, State Representative Marty Walsh, who finished first last night in the Boston mayoral race. There's been a lot of talk about the former, he's still the mayor, Mayor Menino, being being ticked off at John Connally for announcing while Mayor Menino hadn't made up his mind if he was going to stay in or not. But you've had sometimes a strained relationship with Mayor Menino. Jim just mentioned the ground game. Who's going to get the vaunted Menino machine, Marty Walsh, in the final election in Boston?
I'm not sure who's going to get it. I mean, I'd certainly love to have the mayor's support, but, you know, I'm not sure if the mayor's going to get involved in this. You know, the mayor stayed out of this race in the primary. He did not get involved at all, and I think that I don't even know what to think he'll do, but I wouldn't be surprised if he got involved, and I wouldn't be surprised if he stayed out of it. I haven't spoken to the mayor yet. I look forward to talking to him. You know, he's been mayor here for 20 years. He's done a tremendous job running the city of Boston. You know, some of the things he's done I'm going to build on. And we're going to do some of the things that he's done differently.
Hey, you said you haven't spoken to him. Did you call Tom Menino last night?
No, I didn't. I didn't call him last night.
And
last
he didn't
night,
call you?
No, I didn't talk to him last night. No, we didn't talk to him last night.
How many of the other 11 did you speak to last night, Marty Walsh?
I believe a lot of them. Three or four didn't call.
Anybody give you an indication that you were their guy or they were leaning in your direction?
No. You know, I didn't even ask them yesterday. Last night, you know, this race has been going on for 4.5 months. These are great people that ran for mayor. I appreciate anyone who puts their name on for higher office here. And you know, it wasn't appropriate last night to ask them. Let them and their supporters have the night. You know, everyone should be proud of themselves. I think, you know, a lot of people talked about how we kept it above board, this race, and there was a lot of good feelings between one another. And I think that's what people want out of politics, not the back and forth bantering and bickering and negative ads about politics. People want a positive campaign, and that's what the people of Boston got, and that's what I'm going to give them in the final.
Now, Marty Walsh, this may not be an appropriate question either, but I'm going to ask you anyway. I look at the front page of the Boston Globe today. I see you and your longtime partner, the beautiful Lori Higgins of Dorchester. If you become the mayor of the city, Marty Walsh, you're going to get married?
You better ask her that. I certainly can't. Well, she's probably listening now, so Laurie, shut the radio off. I certainly can't ask her today, because if I do, she'll think it's just be for that reason. I'll get in trouble. So you're getting me in trouble.
I'm sorry.
Text us her number. We'll call her directly. Marty Walsh, congratulations. We hope to talk to you a lot during the campaign.
Yeah, thank you, and I'll see you. I'll see both of you soon, and thank you for everything.
Thank you,
Marty. The only question he couldn't handle is the question from Marjorie. And by the way, we taped that earlier this morning with Marty Walsh. We invited John Connally. He was unable to appear today. He's got a city council meeting right now. We expect him to be with us later this week.
I don't know if we could have the mayor of Boston living in sin. I think Marty Walsh may have to take care of the situation.
We're back with Peter Kadzis, Callie Crossley, and Adam Reilly talking about last night and talking about the next 6 weeks.
So what'd you think?
I thought he was tired. I thought he was pretty good. Until you cut his knees out from under him, I thought he was doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Callie, where are you on Mr. Walsh?
No, he reiterated what his main theme is going to be. We perhaps don't differ, me and my opponent, on some of the major issues, but I intend to make it clear that I am different in terms of my broad outreach to the city. That's what he's going to stand on to get some of these communities that maybe could put him over the top.
You know, by the way, we should point out that we invited John Connally, but John Connally, who is still a city council. Oh, you did say that. I'm sorry, Jim. Mm-hmm. He's at the city council meeting right now.
I think that's actually a point where you're going to see some pushback from John Connally and his campaign, because they, too, style themselves as a campaign that has reached out to every neighborhood in the city. And that's one of, when you hear John Connally, I mean, he did this in his sort of half victory, half concession speech last night, and he's been doing it all throughout the campaign, talking about disparities in education, talking about disparities in public safety. I think he's going to be ramping that up. But I think that Connally would vehemently disagree that Marty Walsh reaches out to every neighborhood in the city.
Also, let me just add something, here is where the honey hush comes in. That's what we say down south.
The what?
The honey hush.
What's
honey
that
hush?
Exotic that's phrase,
an,
Kelly?
That's an expression. It means this is where the nitty-gritty hits, okay? Who has been doing it and can point to it specifically? We can all talk. We're here at, you know, in the Harvard area. We can all talk. But who can say, here's what I did, here's what I did, here's what I did?
We're actually here in the gritty Boston neighborhood of Brighton, just for the record.
So I'm just saying that makes a difference, because if you are just coming to the party, then your talk does not impress me.
Yeah, can I say one thing? Okay. One really effective commercial that I thought Connally did in this campaign. Now, some may say it's a small issue, but I think symbols matter a lot. He did his whole, at least first or second commercial exclusively about that expired food in the Boston City schools. And even if you don't have a kid, and he fixed the system, he's got parents talking about it. Even if you don't have a kid there, you say, oh my God, how horrible is that? They were selling, they were feeding crappy old food, even if it wasn't crappy, to kids. So as small as that is, my guess is we're going to hear a little bit more about that. It's not a big idea, but it's a small idea where he actually accomplished
it's
something.
It's an ad. It's worth reminding people, which features, I think, an African-American girl who's
true.
A student in the Boston Public Schools and a Latina mother of a student. So,
well, you get parents in the Boston Public Schools, Peter Kazis.
I am a Boston Public School
that's
parent.
That's right. Yeah. You are a Boston Public School parent. That's right.
Listen.
What do you hear from the other parents?
What do I hear is that they remember that John Conley is the guy before there was any talk of him running for mayor as a freshman city councilor who he said, I'm about schools. When mothers, largely mothers, but mothers and fathers called him, he returned their phone calls. And if he couldn't help them, he'd steer them to people who would. He began in the trenches working with families like mine to help solve, bus scheduling problems, things. Then he moved on to policy issues. Conley has done yeoman work, and the mayor froze him out, no pun intended, when he, when Conley revealed that there was this expired food, the mayor went bananas.
And he also criticized the mayor because Conley was the only person on the school committee, on the city council that did not vote in favor of the teacher's contract that the mayor negotiated, and that ticked off the mayor as well.
Because I'm not the host. I wanted to ask Kelly a question. What was your southern phrase?
Sorry, that's not permitted.
What was the fancy southern phrase you used, the honey hush?
Honey hush.
All right,
honey
so tell me this. Based on what you've seen and based on what you've heard, has one of these candidates been better about reaching out to communities of color than the other?
I haven't seen enough specifics for me. Now I want to see the specificity. I want to see the people themselves talking about it. I think those effective ads, even though they've people get tired of them, are when somebody says, my name is Loretta so-and-so. My kid goes here. My kid ate crappy food, if that's what happened. And John Conley was there. I want someone to say, my name is Joe Oliveira, and I couldn't get in the trades. I've been trying to get in the trades, trying to get a gig in Roxbury to work. And, Marty Walsh walked me through the process to make sure it happened. I look around. Maybe there's just me and one other guy, but neither one of us would have been here without Marty. I want some specificity. Show me.
I don't have any evidence of the following. I just know I have anecdotal response. I think it helped, at least on the margins, John Connolly, that he was the only one who had. And it does take courage to run against Tomanino when everybody thought Tomanino was running for re-election. Does he get any benefit of that post-preliminary? Is that purely a preliminary thing, Peter Kazis?
I think it fades. There's not a big core of Menino haters, but there are some people who have. But it fades.
I don't
fades.
Even think it's about hating Menino. I think you love Menino and think that.
No,
a guy who has the courage to do something, even if he's walking into a storm.
No, I think it fades. It matters more today than it will on election day. Mm-hmm. On election day, it's going to be these two men against each other with the power of their ideas.
And you know what we haven't heard? I mean, I'm sure it's out there. I just don't know about it, and I probably should. But where they are on the whole violence in the city thing, we have heard so much about the millions and millions and millions and millions going to the one fund for the victims, and no one denies that the victims should get taken care of because people are going to have serious medical issues for the rest of their lives. But the contrast in the city of Boston with the shootings. So, that's a big deal. That is a big deal if you're in a very violent neighborhood.
To that end, I just want to read. I have a little – I don't have sound, but I have – what John Connolly said last night on that topic.
Just remember you're not the host, though, when you do this. Is that okay? Go ahead, I'm Adam Riley. I'm sorry.
So last night, John Connolly's bite was whether it's local terrorism on Boylston Street or the terrorism of street gangs on Talbot Avenue, every loss of life chips away at the soul of our city. Sadly, we live in a society that has devalued the lives of Black and Latino young men. I think we're going to hear more of that, but I don't think that's an idea that Marty Walsh would disagree with.
Yeah.
Are probably of like mind.
As I said, who's just coming to the party and who's been out there?
As there's a party, I'm happy. Let me ask you both something. Does it, occasionally you hear a candidate, admittedly not one of the two top people, but middle-tier people, who decide, I'm running for president, I'm going to tell you who my Secretary of State's going to be because it's going to get me votes. Do either of these men drop hints about who the school super, two huge jobs, who the school superintendent and who the police chief and commissioner is going to be during this campaign, Peter Katsas?
Not for those two jobs. Maybe for the BRA.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe for the BRA. Those two jobs are too tricky to recruit for.
Do you agree with that, Kelly Crossley?
I think I do agree with that. I think you get more bang for your buck by saying, from the remaining folks, so-and-so stands with me, and I agree with he, her ideas or his ideas about this, and so I can deduce from the direction you're going in certain things about what you'd be looking for in a police superintendent or a school superintendent.
Yeah. You know, the thing about the deaths in Dorchester, Mattapan, Roxbury, at some point the Menino administration may point out that, look, they have gotten federal funds, several million dollars of money go to those neighborhoods, not after the kids are shot, but before to try to mitigate. So, you know, I'm not trying to make the situation, mitigate the situation or make it seem worse, but there is effort being made before the fact. What's so frustrating is the efforts don't seem to be working.
Well, also, but in terms of what high-profile moments, when a governor and a mayor ask people to give money and $70 million and counting is raised, and they don't do a comparable, I'm not saying they should, but the symbolism of not doing a comparable thing so a woman can bury her son.
The symbolism of Amy Lord, who
that's what I was going to say. John Barrows, I think, put it so well.
He did.
What's that?
Tell people what Barrows said.
Well, John Barrows said, I was devastated by Amy Lord, the young woman who was killed in South Boston. I thought that was horrible. I made it my business to go to the memorial service for her. And when I got there, in the midst of my, you know, wanting to participate in this public grieving, I noticed everybody who was from a position of power in the government was there to grieve. Nothing wrong with that. They should be. But I don't see that when it happens in my
It was really powerful when he said that at the NAACP forum. He said, in my Boston, that's not how it works. People don't show up like that.
I mean, I think, you know, having been a reporter for a long time in Boston, there is no question. Things happen. When they had the windows shot out on up at the
Newbury's.
State House, my God, you know, the whole city came to a halt. My God, they put windows shot out on Beacon Hill. And then you have kids murdered all the time that are not even involved in any wrongdoing. They're in the wrong place at the wrong time. The disparity to me is like totally obvious. And the clearance rate is not very good in crimes in Dorchester. One of the reasons is because they don't protect the witnesses who are scared to death to come down and testify.
Well, you don't even have to go that high or that deep. And that is a real huge problem that somebody is going to have to address in a way that resonates with people and acknowledges they see the difference and what are they going to do about it. How about just letting people in certain communities get the city services for which they have paid? Whoever.
Like what? What are you talking about?
This is the complaint at all of these forums from people in certain communities that, where's my garbage pickup on a regular basis? Where's my street cleaning? Where's my snow removal? Why do I pay for these services too? And why is it that even though I complain about it, the people don't address these issues in the same vigor and verve as they do in other communities?
Yeah. Okay,
let's see who says that.
Before you three go, 15 seconds each, starting with you, Peter Katsas. Who's the also-ran? Who's the person of the remaining 10 who's going to have a high profile into the future? Who's number one on that list?
John Barrows.
And how about that? How about it, Kelly Crossley?
Well, John Barrows is one, but I got to say there's some other people on that list as well. But John Barrows, definitely, because people who didn't know him, we knew him in this room in other ways, but they were very... I'm surprised that people are surprised at the embarrassment of riches that we have here in Boston.
How about it, Adam Riley?
I hate to be a one-note commentator here, but John Barrows, he ran a really good campaign. I hope he runs for at-large city council and remains a strong presence.
Fair enough. Kelly Crossley, Peter Katsas, Adam Riley, all our colleagues, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Kelly Crossley is, of course, the host of Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley. Peter Katsas is WGBH's political analyst and contributor. And Adam Riley is a reporter here for radio and TV, specifically Greater Boston, which you can catch weeknights at 7 o'clock on Channel 2. And you can often see Adam Riley sitting right there next to Emily Rooney. When we come back, it's time for Open Mic with Boston Globe editor Brian McGroy. Stay tuned for his take on the mayor's race, the Pope, and bicycle riding in Netherlands. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Even with hindsight being 2020, betting on a woman founding an entirely new industry in the throes of the Great Depression still seems pretty unlikely. But it's the story of Estée Lauder.
Cosmetic sales like candy sales and alcohol sales and ice cream sales go up. in downtimes.
I'm Kara Miller. What went right for Estee Lauder on Innovation Hub, Thursday night at 9 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Stana Stairlifts, whose stairway chair lifts can make it easier and safer to get up and down stairs. You can learn more at stairliftboston.com or by calling 1-800-UPSTAIR. And Boston University's Executive MBA, Real Connections for the Real World, online information session September 28th at 9 a.m. You can learn more at bu.edu/EMBA.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. He joins us every single Wednesday. Yeah, it is Wednesday. Wednesday at about 1 o'clock. He's the editor of the Boston Globe. Hello there, Brian McGorry.
Hello there, Jim Browdy. How are you?
Excellent.
Hey, Brian McGorry. Thank you for joining us as always. You know, Brian, Jim is obsessed with the kind of Irish chest thumping going on now because we've got a Walsh and a Conley in the final election. We're a majority-minority city, and no person of color rose to the top, even though Charlotte Gola Ritchie came in third. So, what do you see as the message of yesterday? Is it Irish chest thumping or not?
I don't see that message. I've heard people say, oh, my God, we're going back to the Boston of old. And that to me is a little bit insulting because it implies that, Walsh and Conley are not, cosmopolitan at all or representative of a new Boston. And I think that both of them have attributes that do indicate that they're part of where the city is going, not where it's already been. There were several high-quality candidates that added diversity to this field, Gola Ritchie, Felix Arroyo, John Barros, and they ended up splintering the vote. Gola Ritchie didn't catch on like some people in the minority communities thought she would. So the message I get here isn't anything profound. It's that, we came close to getting a minority candidate in the finals, but it didn't work out this time. That said, I think there were three very good ones and three good minority candidates that would have a shot at a future election.
Let's stay on that just, though, for 1 second. I looked up some numbers yesterday. In 1983, when the person of color made the final, Mel King, he got 48,000 votes. Obviously within a couple hundred of Ray Flynn, they both made the final. 48,000 votes when the city was two-thirds white. Now we're a majority-minority city, and Charlotte Gola Ritchie, the top vote-getter amongst people of color, is 15,000. There is some message in there. I'm not saying it's pernicious, but there is something, isn't there?
Well, what is it? What's the message?
I don't know. Is there either? I don't know what the turnout numbers are in communities of color. Anecdotally, my understanding is in communities of color, there were a lot of votes for white candidates, which I guess some would consider a good thing. But it's a little distressing to me that 30 years ago there was a guy there when the city was two-thirds white, and today no one could crack the top ranks. You're not troubled by it, obviously.
I'm not deeply troubled by it because I don't think this race had great racial overtones that I would find troubling.
I think you're exactly right. I think he is obsessed, but I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead, Brian.
No, I mean, not a lot more to add, Marjorie. I appreciate it. I just don't think that this race exposed or propelled any great racial divide. I thought it was a well-run campaign, and I thought a couple of white guys ended up on top, but a few minority candidates really did themselves proud here.
Okay, we'll talk about those two candidates in a second. Let me deal with my other obsession. We'll get it out of the way, and then we can move on.
Roughly, Marjorie, just out of curiosity, how much time off the air do you spend on Jim's obsessions? I mean, it's
an awful lot, Brian. We have to have everything arranged 2x2 and 4x4.
You notice it's a word that both Pope Francis and
right.
I both use quite a bit.
That's
Here's
right.
my other one.
Only red peanut M&Ms in the silver chalice
exactly.
in a private room before you go on the air.
What about the turnout thing, Brian McGorry? Roughly 30%. There was a great Greg Whalen on NECN interviewed a guy last night who was terrific. He says, if you don't vote, you shouldn't have an opinion. And I have to say, first election in 20 years without an incumbent there, I think a stunningly qualified field of credible candidates, at least 8-9 of these people. 7 out of 10 people stayed home?
it's discouraging. There's no way to there's no way to put lipstick on that. It's it is discouraging. It's
why do you think? What's your take? Why do you think so many
here's
people
why
set
I think.
It up?
I think you know, we have been waiting for an open campaign in Boston for a long time, and when we got it, we ended up with a field that was so crowded that it ended up to be something of a cacophony, and it was tough for any candidate to break out. It was tough for any candidate to inspire a great following. So what you ended up having was a lot of noise and clutter, and a lot of voters, I suspect, simply turned it off. And I am hoping that the finals will be a little clearer to people, a little easier for us to cover. This was not an easy race for us to cover in the news media. And I think that perhaps the voters might get a little more engaged this time around.
You know, one last thing about easier to cover, if I just may for a second. We spoke to Marty Walsh a couple of minutes ago, and we asked him a question about, isn't it fair to state that the two of you, if you take away experience and personal background, the two of you are very similar on the issues? And he said, yeah, that's pretty much true. That makes it pretty difficult to cover even when there are only two people in the race, doesn't it?
Yeah, no. I think that issue stands are part of it. It's also where you've been in this life that indicates where you might go and where you might take the city with you. I think that's critical in any campaign. You know, look at issue stands are what candidates would prefer that we devote ourselves to in the news media. And, you know, we do spend a lot of time on that, but we also know that issue stands can often change under pressure. And when somebody goes from a candidate to an actual government official, you know, things look different when the perspective changes. So we like to spend a lot of time also looking at the backgrounds of these people and what they've done and what they've accomplished and what they haven't accomplished to glean information about, you know, how they might perform as mayor. So these two have lived, you know, look, they let's be honest here, they don't look dissimilar. They both have Irish sounding last names.
And Marty Walsh looks like the map of Ireland, doesn't he?
I mean, you know, look, this is all true, but the reality is they do, if you, you know, go beyond the face of it, they do have different backgrounds.
Oh, they truly do.
They do emphasize different things in the way they have gone through their political careers. And I happen to think this is going to be a pretty interesting race we've got coming up.
So you wonder what's going to happen with the vaunted Tomenino machine. You know, John Conley came out first, of course, and I'm sure ticked off the mayor before the mayor decided whether or not he was going to run again. But the relationship between Walsh and Menino has not always been smooth sailing either. So what do you think happened? Do you think Menino does stay back, or do you think his people en masse go for one of these guys?
I honestly don't know. I mean, look, I'm not the first one to say it. There's no great love lost between Menino and either of these candidates. And it's going to be really interesting watching them kind of tap dance around that issue through the campaign, because Menino remains really, really popular among the electorate. And so it's going to be kind of a nuanced situation out there. I don't know what Menino does, what Tom Menino does. My prediction is he does virtually nothing. And, you know, where his people may end up, you know, that'll probably be left up to them.
Where does he end up? I mean, I've spent a lot of time. It's another obsession of mine. This is a mini obsession, I must admit. It doesn't rise to the level of the earlier ones, Brian McGrory. What does Tom Menino do? I mean, it seems to me Ray Flynn belonged at the Vatican. His Catholicism is such a huge part of who he is. Kevin White at BU made. I mean, where does Tom Menino go in January? What does he do?
Well, you know that he's working on a book with the great Jack Beatty.
Yeah.
And, I think that's a project that he's really, really thrown himself into. And come January, I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing here, and you're guessing as well. I suspect that he will end up at a university here in town, but that's purely guesswork. I think that, you know, maybe he teaches a seminar. Maybe he, I don't know. I mean, I've always just assumed that he ends up at an area university.
You know,
does he have a driver's license?
Well,
that
he's,
is a
you
very
know, he's had a driver
question.
For a very, very long time.
He's got a bike.
He's got a bike. Yeah, we'll see.
I thought
we'll
he put that thing away. When,
after the accident.
Yeah. I mean, it's... I don't know. There's a whole new world awaiting Tom Menino, and I think for him it may be a pretty exciting one.
You know, one last thing about the dynamics, the identity politics and Jim's upset that candidates of color didn't do better and all that kind of stuff. You've been around Boston forever. You grew up here, and I've been around for a pretty long time. I see this as kind of an encouraging thing because I had the sense there wasn't a lot of identity politics, and Boston in 1983 was so much scarier, so much more divided, so much more polarized around race. It was just a few years after busing. To me, the whole city is so different now. I was over at a polling place looking for David James Wyatt yesterday, the guy that, you know, has kind of been an elusive candidate in this race. And so many people, and this is a black district, were voting for white candidates. You know, they were voting for Dan Conley because of crime. They were voting for John Conley because of schools. And I thought that was an encouraging thing about where we are in 2013 in Boston.
Well, it's an excellent point, Marjorie, and I liked your column a lot today on Gola Richie. I didn't entirely agree with it, but I liked it a lot. In some ways, I'm wondering if Jim, and this is a serious point, if Jim would rather have a black candidate and a white candidate facing off in a divided city that is about to launch into a campaign with deep racial overtones. If he thinks that that would be more representative of a cosmopolitan, a forward-thinking Boston. And I disagree with the premise and the words that I've just put in his mouth.
Well, I disagree with your premise. I mean, my notion, Brian, I'm not saying if a person of color made the final.
I think you're right, Brian.
That I am waiting for racial.
Jim's still talking?
I am. Let's move on. Hey, Brian, I know one of your favorite segment parts of these weekly discussions we have is when we get to issues about running the newspaper. So we have two of them for you. Is that okay with you? Now, sure. The first one, we're going to question your financial decision making. Now, Brian, you chose to send a reporter, a great reporter, Martine Powers, to the Netherlands at great expense of the Boston Globe to write a piece about what she called a cyclist mecca. When we are aware that you have utter contempt for all things cycling, well, how do you defend that decision, Brian?
So in the off chance that one Mr. John Henry is listening, I want you to know we got discount airfare to the to the Netherlands. We booked it far in advance, and Martine, of course, flew coach class.
So did she move you? She paints, I have to say, I read this cover to cover.
It was great.
She writes a terrific story.
So does that, you and Marjorie are, let's face it, we both know, you are anti-cyclist types, at least in the city. Did this begin to move you as to whether there is a future for the bicycle in the city?
It's a dramatic difference, Brian, about how they do it over there. Tell people.
Martine wrote a fantastic story, actually stories, on just how serious they take it. They have dedicated not just lanes, but, you know, entirely different tracks on different levels, barricaded away from
yes.
cars.
As they should here, yes. I agree.
They do cyclist training when kids are very young so that they grow up with the mentality of what it is to be a polite cyclist, and with greater knowledge of what's going on around you. I happen to think that cycling is a terrific thing done right, and I don't think from any aspect here in Boston we do it right, from the automotive aspect, from the pedestrian walkers aspect, or from the cyclist aspect. I think there's a lot of blame that can go around, and we sent a reporter over to the Netherlands, a really terrific reporter, Martine Powers, and she did a great job on how it can be different. And my hope is that city officials here, university officials here, take a hard look at that story, see that it doesn't have to be the way it is, and start making plans to change things.
Exactly.
So
that's
too.
The whole issue. If bikes were segregated from pedestrians and cars, it would be a whole different world.
As they are on Western Avenue, in a fairly primitive way, but they are. They've adopted that thing in last year, in any case.
Brian, one last quick question for me. You know, at the Herald, we always are rooting for our local sports teams beyond the obvious reasons, because Tom Brady, winning, the Red Sox winning, means a lot in terms of newspaper sales. It's got to be the same way at the Globe. I mean, it's a great thing for business to have the Red Sox in the finals or whatever they are. What do they win? The American
playoffs.
League?
They're in the playoffs.
I'm not a big sports person, but you know what I'm saying. They could be in the World Series again.
What's the question?
How much does that matter? How much does that matter to sales?
Look, at any time a team makes, the World Series or the Super Bowl or the finals in the NHL or the NBA. Look, it's terrific for us. It costs us a ton of money to go cover this stuff because we end up sending an incredible array of reporters, photographers, videographers, and whatnot to these events. But obviously, when they win, you know, there are parades and there are people that take out ads and readership goes up and all of that kind of stuff. But the reality is, Marjorie, it's also just good for the city.
Yeah.
I mean, sports is about, to a great extent, community. It gets people talking. It gives people a common bond. And, you know, the Red Sox do well. The Patriots do well. It in some very real way improves the mood of the collective us.
Hey, one last thing, Brian, I just thought of as you were talking. I don't know what prompted me. Obviously, the Globe won a lot of prizes for your coverage of the sex abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. What's your quick reaction to the first few months of Pope Francis?
It's been unbelievable. I mean, it's really been breathtaking to see this unfold in a really refreshing way. And, you know, my own take is that we are witnessing kind of the first steps in a rehabilitation of the reputation of the Catholic Church unfolding right in front of us. And this is a story that bears very close watching in the days, weeks, months, years ahead.
Marjorie has a big smile on her face.
Well,
I feel
like Chris Matthews listening to Barack Obama. You know, I read these words from the Pope, and I got a thrill up my leg.
I mean, come on. This is pretty exciting.
Are you kidding? Really, I was exciting. Euphoric. I've been euphoric for days over this because it makes me very hopeful as a Catholic that things can change, and it's pretty heartening.
Yeah. Did you see where Benedict came out of
you were going to say hiding?
Wrong word. That's the
he
wrong
trotted
word.
Out in his
and
red
did
shoes.
What? No, I didn't. What did he do?
Yeah, he came out and wrote a letter to an atheist over in Italy.
Saying?
Kind of defending some of the things he did. I don't have it right here in front of me, but it was an interesting play.
No.
Just take a look at him.
We will.
Take a look at that, too.
Hey, Brian McGorry, great to talk to you. We'll talk to you next week.
Jim, Marjorie, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been tough for him.
Brian McGorry joins us every Wednesday for Open Mic. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Christopher Lydon, who ran for mayor himself, and he's going to give us his take on the mayor's race in Boston. When we come back, it is Ask the Governor. Governor Deval Patrick is here with us in Studio 3. He's taking your calls, your questions, and ours. Our number, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. This is 89.7 WGBH.
I'm David Bernstein. I'm a contributing analyst for WGBH News. I live here and I work here. Local reporting and analysis, especially on politics, is really important to people because they get so much of it nationally. But they really don't get enough sometimes at the local level of who is doing what with their money and their policies, connecting what politicians do to everybody's lives. David Bernstein, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater, presenting the Modern Family musical La Cage aux Folles, starring the Nanny's Charles Shaughnessy. North Shore Music Theater in Beverly, September 24th through October 6th. NSMT.org. And Earthflight, a nature special presentation. Take a breathtaking voyage on the wings of the world's birds. This week, explore South America. Don't miss Earthflight, Wednesday at 8 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Brody. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is Governor Deval Patrick. As you know,
hello.
He joins us. Hello there, Governor. He joins us every month for Ask the Governor, and he will take your calls at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. Good to see you, Governor Patrick.
Nice to see you.
Hello, Governor Patrick. So Jim Brody has been kind of ranting and raving all morning about the mayor's election.
Not,
he has.
Not Jim Brody. Ranting and raving.
Ranting and raving about the mayoral election in Boston. He's upset about a low turnout. He's upset about what's the term of the day, the Irish chest thumping, because we have another Irish guy.
I didn't put it that way, but go ahead.
Running the town, that we didn't have in a minority, majority city and all that kind of stuff. What is your take on the mayor's race, Governor Patrick? I'm sure you know Representative Walsh and City Councilor John Conley.
I do. I know them both and a number of the other candidates. You know, Charlotte is a friend and a colleague, Charlotte Golar-Ritchie and Felix Arroyo was helpful in my first campaign, very active in it. John Barros is someone we've worked with through the Neighborhood Coalition and is just an incredible person. It was fun that it was such a rich and deep field, and I think if you noticed, both of the prevailing candidates in the preliminary, among the first things they said was how important it was to reach out to all communities in the Commonwealth and in the city. And I think that's very important. I think the presence of residents and voters who are of the wide variety of backgrounds we have in the city and indeed in the Commonwealth is something that wise political figures and would-be leaders are taking account of and having to deal with, and that's good.
By the way, Marjorie misstated my position a little, so if I may recharacterize.
Okay, dig out of the hole, Jim.
you know, we talked before, I think it was with Brian McGrory a couple of minutes ago. 30 years ago, Mel King got 48,000 votes when he gets in the runoff with Ray Flynn, obviously the first African-American to be in a final. We were two-thirds white then. We're now a majority-minority city. And this is not negative at all about the two men who did well enough to be in the final. But the fact that no person of color made it into the final, what does that say to you about the city in 2013?
Well, first of all, when Mel King ran, how many candidates were in the field?
Nine.
So this is a bigger field.
It is a bigger field.
That's the first thing I'd say. And the second thing I'd say is that you know, the population of color is not monolithic, and they're not focused on color alone. They're focused on crime and education and job opportunities and affordable housing and so on. And that and I think that has to be acknowledged and credited. And I think the successful candidates are the ones, number one, who were, and I would say many of the candidates were successful. I'm not talking about success just in the sense of the two who emerged from the preliminary, but that the successful candidates were the ones, number one, who spoke to those aspirations and those concerns of all of the citizens, and number two, who built at the grassroots, which is, you know, just you've heard me say it before. Never, ever underestimate the power of the grassroots.
Our number is 877-301-8970 if you'd like to speak directly to the governor. If you want to email a question in, you can do that at wgbhnews.org. And we have a ton of tweeted questions. They go to @BOS Public Radio.
We're moving on from the mayor's race.
Yes, we are.
Okay. They're up on Beacon Hill today debating this technology tax. And this has been kind of confusing for people because at the beginning, you and many other people were all in favor of this tech tax. Now you're not in favor of this tech tax, and other people aren't either. So what happened?
I think we listened and learned. It was among a host of things in my original budget. You remember that I proposed. The legislature went in a very different direction, as you recall, with the support of the business community, indeed with the support of the Mass High Tech Council. And when they put out the bill that they ultimately announced, Mike Widmer from Mass Taxpayers Foundation, the Mass High Tech Council, the Chamber, the AIM, all the business leaders put out very supportive statements. And some of those same business leaders were the ones leading the charge ultimately to repeal it, which I think, by the way, is part of the reason why it's confusing to people and part of why the politics of this is complicated on Beacon Hill.
Right.
But I remember we had a conversation in the summertime. I called the speaker. This is after session. I had calls individually with the Speaker and the Senate President and then together with them just to get a sense about what they wanted to do and how they were thinking about it. And then we convened leaders from the tech industry because remember DOR, which is the agency that's responsible for enforcing this and writing the rules. Department of Revenue had been very involved with the industry leadership about how to write the rules so that they were plain and simple, understandable and limited. And the more they worked with the industry and the more the industry got involved with DOR, the clearer it was that it was hard to write clear rules. And so when we got everybody together, not everybody, but a representative group of industry leaders with the speaker and the Senate president and the governor's office, and we were talking about what the right solution is, I think some came into that meeting thinking, let's figure out a way to interpret this so everybody is comfortable and it's workable, and then came out of the meeting thinking, you know what, it may be that the better solution is just to make it go away. And I'm, you know, leaving aside whether it could have been you know, whether it actually is so complicated as to be harmful to the industry, and I think that's a debatable question. But the impact on our reputation as a tech hub was, to me, very worrisome, and that's one of the reasons why I came around.
Can we spend a minute before we get to the coals on what the money was going to go for? You originally wanted roughly $1 billion for transportation infrastructure and a variety of transportation things. You got $500 million, give or take a few, in new taxes, including the $161 million for the tech tax. The legislature argues a few hundred million more, and at least until those tolls come down. Forgetting that for a second, they seem to show no interest in replacing the $161 million, except maybe on a one-time basis out of the rainy day fund, which I know you're not crazy about because it's supposed to be for emergencies. So you got maybe two-thirds of what you wanted with money for a really important priority. You're now about to lose another $161 million. What do you do?
Well, it's very concerning. I mean, I've been clear both publicly and privately that the transportation financing that the legislature ultimately enacted over my veto is not adequate for our needs. And I would just offer a friendly correction. I didn't want $1 billion. We need $1 billion to deliver a modern transportation system. And I did a lot of work with a lot of people inside the legislature and in the business community to create an environment where they could do that. Not necessarily in the way that I had originally proposed, but I put a lot of things on the table so they could take things off the table and be the ones whittling it down. But I think that the appetite in the legislature for dealing with this right now is just not very great. And that's too bad, but it's not something I can control.
So would you buy a solution?
The public needs to understand we're going to need to come back to this, probably after I have left. Meaning after my term is over, we are going to have to come back to it. But in the meantime, we're going to make the investments we can and get as far along as we can before I leave.
Well, I want to ask you about one of those investments, and then finally we'll get to the coals. You were trumpeting the other day that a major environmental hurdle, if that's a proper use of the term, had been overcome, and to the joy of people in the South Coast, that the South Coast Rail was proceeding apace. You get roughly two-thirds of the money you want. Then you lose another $161 million, theoretically, maybe replaced for 1 year, maybe not. How do you lose that much money and then go ahead with a proposition that could cost a couple of $1 billion?
Well, it's going to cost about $1.8 billion, and we'd be crazy not to do it, frankly, because there is a workforce and a stock of affordable housing and job opportunities there and all along the corridor, which cannot be unlocked without transportation infrastructure, and particularly this train, which it was wonderful when we were down there to announce what you referred to as a what'd you call it?
A hurdle, whatever, yeah.
Was the approval process from the Army Corps of Engineers for the preferred route, which is the fastest and most economic route. And we applied for this 5 years ago, I think it was. and it was just approved on Monday. So a huge element of this project has been achieved, and really we're now ready to get into design and construction, final design and construction. And when we were down there to announce this in New Bedford, I called attention to the fact that the train stopped running, by the way, on this same right-of-way 55 years ago. And a gentleman came up to me and said, I was the ticket taker on that last train 55 years ago. He's in early 90s. He had on his teacup. It was so much fun. And he said, I'd said I was going to be here when that train started again, which made me think we better get on with the construction.
But how can you afford? I guess what my question was, quickly, if I can,
it's going to have to come.
Where's the money come from when you're losing it?
It's going to have to come from other things. I mean, this is right before we went right before we went on the air, Jim,
yeah.
And you were asking, I was telling you that I was out in Malden today having a walk around Malden, the downtown area near the T-stop. And because of the Orange Line and a little bit of public infrastructure investment, private investors are coming in and building a half a dozen different housing initiatives, some market rates, some affordable, and also mixed-use development going on in the area close to the T-stop. And that's what has to happen. We have to start connecting these dots and stop talking about transportation as if it's some abstract thing out there that isn't related to meeting our housing needs, our job creation needs, and the rest.
Okay, we're talking with Governor Deval Patrick, and let us take some calls. Go ahead, Governor. There's your calls.
Let's see. Brian is calling from Arlington. Brian?
Yes, Mr. Governor. I have sort of a big picture question that I've never really understood about Massachusetts politics and taxation, and that is, why do we have basically a flat tax rather than progressive taxation?
You're talking about income tax, Brian?
Yeah. Why haven't you tried to change that as governor since, and we've actually made it more regressive with a higher sales tax, too, now? So if we're supposedly more progressive than the rest of the nation, why do we have a federal progressive income tax, but it's basically flat on the state level, and what can we do about that?
Great question. So first of all, leaving aside qualification there about our being a progressive state, we have a flat tax because the Constitution requires a flat tax, and making it progressive in the sense that I think you mean requires a constitutional change, which is not easy to do and shouldn't be easy to do. What I did propose this last year was a way to, through exemptions, have it effectively more progressive, which means to say that if we'd raised the income tax and lowered the sales tax and raised the exemptions as I proposed, then for half the people for half the people in the Commonwealth who are in the middle or working poor, their total taxes would either stay the same or go down. And for the people who are making a little bit more, in many cases a lot more, they pay a little bit more. But that's the kind of tax – that's the kind of thing we can do. And I'm sorry if this sounds a little too wonkish, but that's the kind of thing we can do in the absence of a constitutional change. Although, Jim, didn't you work on this?
Yes.
I may have done it.
I was in his Robin Hood days. I didn't know if the governor was aware of
Robin
that.
Robin Hoodian is the appropriate.
Yes.
By the way, the answer is
– you want to speak to Brian then?
There have been five attempts to amend the Constitution. I led the effort in the 90s, the fifth unsuccessful time. And, Brian, the good news is we lost by a narrow 71-29% margin. So the appetite for it apparently is not there yet, but the governor's right. You have to amend the Constitution.
Well,
it is a real tedious process.
The appetite for amending the Constitution, I cannot speak to, but all the polling, including in your paper, Marjorie,
you're correct.
Was in favor of the design of what we had proposed. I mean, all of it. I don't think there was one poll against it.
Well, there was a lot of fear on the other side. We can talk about that another day. But, Brian, thank you so much for the call. Governor.
Ned is calling from Newton. Ned.
Jim and Marjorie, thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
And, thanks for calling.
Yeah, great. And it's a wonderful opportunity to talk to you, Governor. And I just wanted to say that I was at the public hearing with the Public Safety Committee of the legislature last week on the gun reform legislation that's been proposed.
Yes.
And you were wonderful. And
thank you.
Very great to know that somebody in your position of power is speaking aggressively about this issue. It seems like a real opportunity for us, yet I sense the possibility that this may slip away. I know Speaker DeLeo set up a task force, but really haven't gone anywhere with it. Hoping that Representative Naughton, who's the chair of the Public Safety Committee, is going to move this along and we'll get something constructive. But
did you stay for the whole hearing, Ned?
I think it was, 10, 12 hours long?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
I was there for about 4 or 5 hours,
mm-hmm.
So not the whole a lot of emotion, as you can imagine.
Right.
Hearings from
on both sides.
Gun owners, a lot of it. But we need some specific steps to be taken. I'm concerned the opportunity may slip away as it did, nationally. And I'm wondering what your feeling is as to whether or not we're going to have some real change.
I don't know. And that's an honest answer. I mean, we have, and many people point to it, with pride, and I do too, we have the most restrictive gun laws in the country or among the most restrictive gun laws in the country right now in Massachusetts. At the same time, you can buy guns in bulk, and it's hard for me to understand why, when we have a the problem of so-called straw purchases, where people buy lawfully in bulk and then sell them on, in some cases, unlawfully, or to people who are not lawfully authorized to own guns, why we can't slow that that process or in some way intervene in that problem. Assault weapons and are banned in Massachusetts. There is at least some ambiguity about high capacity magazines. I think I'm using the right term, but
you put a lot of bullets in and shoot a lot
exactly.
at one time.
I think there's at least some ambiguity around that. And by the way, I think there's some consensus, Ned, about expanding the background checks to include accessible information around mental health without compromising the privacy interests of patients. Hank Naughton, whom you mentioned, Chairman Naughton on the House side, has done a tremendous amount of work moving the committee hearings around the state and really listening hard to everybody. And there are a number of different proposals out there, and I think he wants to come up with an omnibus bill, not to say that it has every proposal that has been made, but those around which there is most consensus. And I would love to see that enacted or acted on by the legislature soon.
Governor, a couple of questions. Ned, thank you very much for the call. Just if people don't know, you proposed getting rid of not allowing this straw purchase thing where right. somebody does. And you've proposed repeatedly, and I have no idea what the argument against this is, limiting purchases to one gun a month. But I have two questions for you. One, why waste any time strengthening gun laws on a state level when, no matter how strong they are, you can drive up to New Hampshire
yeah.
or to another state and do
yeah.
it? Isn't it it's all feds? And
yeah.
number two, would any mental health change that you proposed or supported have caused an Aaron Alexis, for example, who was never committed to anything? All he had done, he had seen a
shrink. You're talking about the fellow from the Naval Yard?
The shooter at the Navy Yard.
Yeah.
Is there anything that would have been that you proposed or supported that would have captured, I don't mean that literally, but it would have.
I know where you're going.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that. It's very interesting. I visited with two of the parents of two of the children who were killed at Sandy Hook
mm-hmm.
right before my testimony, and they'd come up and I believe they testified that day as well.
Yeah, they did.
At the hearing. Amazing people, amazing strength, and really quite moving how they have taken their grief and turned it into a very respectful advocacy. And when I say respectful, I mean of the arguments on the other side as well. And one of the parents said to me that she wasn't confident that the elements around, of the proposal she was going to testify about necessarily would have prevented what happened. She said, but it was important to act where we could to limit the unlawful access of highly dangerous guns. And if she had some – and she felt, and I think the rest of us did, she has some pretty strong credibility on that subject.
We're talking to Governor Deval Patrick. You can speak to him directly at 877-301-8970.
Now, I wanted to ask you one quick thing before we get back to the calls about you've been down stumping for Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, who's running for the United States Senate down in New Jersey.
I have to tell you a funny story.
Oh, tell us.
I'm sorry.
You tell your story.
So I went down to there were two celebrations of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
Uh-huh.
And there was one on a Saturday and then one on the actual
okay.
day in August.
Okay.
And I went down to the one on a Saturday and Mayor Booker spoke, as did others. It was a wonderful speech. It was a very moving time. And after the program, there was to be a march, and I couldn't stay for the march. So the speaking finished, and I started to leave. And I'm heading back to catch my ride to get to the airport, and this guy comes running up. Huge crowd there. This guy comes running up. Mr. Booker. and I didn't, you know. I
hope you didn't disabuse
no,
him.
No, first of all, I didn't turn because it wasn't me. And he comes up and he said, and then he grabbed me on the shoulder and he said, you're Cory Booker. And I said, no, I'm not. And he said, come on, come on. He said, I'm Cory Booker. I'm your Cory Booker. Let me take a picture with you. And I said, you see how tall I am or am not? I said, I am not Cory Booker.
Did you take the picture?
I took the picture.
Did you tell him who you were?
No, I think he sorted it out.
Well, I think anyway. You should be flattered. I think that's...
Cory Booker's a handsome
guy. He's a handsome guy. Man. Not that you aren't, of course, Governor Patrick.
Thank you for cleaning that up.
What I wanted to ask you about is you were pretty tough when you were talking. Here's the quote from what you had to say when you were down there. You were talking about the Booker's opponent and other Tea Party conservatives that are trying to defund Obamacare as, quote, a band of radicals who want to drag the country and its economy over a cliff. It's amazing that people would publicly advocate to harm American citizens as a policy position. That's a tough quote. On the other side, there are people who like Obamacare and are very happy that we're going to have some health insurance, who still don't understand, you know, what we're going to get, what we're not going to get. Yeah. Is it going to cost us money? Is it going to
So the first thing – I'm sorry. You say
– No, just I'm just wondering – I'm just wondering why the president that you know as a politician, as a friend, convince people. He's not selling this thing still.
I think that's been a real problem, Marjorie. I really agree with you. I think we've talked about this in the past. You know, when we launched the implementation here of health care reform, we had a pretty well thought out and coordinated and actually evolving plan that went beyond government because, you know, the healthcare industry, business leaders, labor were all a part of selling the thing. You remember that one of the biggest issues here was the so-called invincibles, who are the young, sort of 20s, healthy men who were uninsured and weren't going to sign up because they felt they'd always be young and healthy and strong. But the principle of insurance is having as many people in the pool as possible so you can spread the risk as widely as possible. And so we engaged with sports teams who would make announcements during games about how important it was to sign up. And so, I mean, it was very much a whole community, all hands on deck, explain the thing, answer questions, and encourage people to be a part of it. And the president and the administration have not done that or hadn't done that. They're doing it now, but they're coming from behind because the other side has been trashing it from the day it was enacted.
But Governor, if the other side is so far winning the public debate, the most recent poll I saw was something like a 10-point margin of the American people being opposed to Obamacare as opposed to supporting it. As much as Ted Cruz was called by his own Republican colleague Peter King a total fraud, why shouldn't the Republicans fight to defund something that the American people don't support?
Well, first of all, what the American people don't support, according to those to some of those polls, is something called Obamacare. Ask them if they like the idea of keeping their kids on their insurance until 26 or not being thrown off their insurance if they get sick and when they get sick, that they don't have the risk anymore of going bankrupt on account of a serious and unexpected illness, that you can get insurance even if you have a previous condition. I think I'm using the right
pre-existing condition.
They like all those things, and they didn't have any of those things until Obamacare went into effect. And you know, I have said to the secretary and to the president, you know, you should let us tell our story about what's happened in Massachusetts because it's been so overwhelmingly positive, and people experience it that way. You'll see when the rates come out for the quarter. I guess it's the one that starts in January. You know, we're at a 0 to 2%, less than 2% increase in rates. That's a big change from where we used to be. And with the range of new products that are available, particularly if you're an individual, your opportunity to see your rates go down is pretty significant. And I'm talking about not just a percentage or two, like 10, 12%. So I think there is a lot more to be done in talking about the value of this. And my point in the quote that you read, Marjorie, is that there's something really upside down about trashing an idea which helps people help themselves. And does it in a market-based way, which is what Republicans used to say they preferred.
Let's go back to the calls. Governor Patrick.
Let's see. Bob is calling from Boston. Bob, you there?
Hello, Governor.
Good morning or afternoon.
Good afternoon. Before my two questions, I want to say I think
one per customer.
Okay, I think you've been an excellent governor.
Oh, take your time. Ask as many. Thank you.
And I really applaud your transportation initiative. The problem I see is this, that I think the MBTA focus is in eastern Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
I've lived most of my life in western Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm sure you know, we have two states. One, Massachusetts, that's relatively prosperous, and the other is the western four counties,
mm-hmm.
which always have a much higher unemployment rate, as well as lower housing costs and so forth. It's a different part of the state.
Yes.
Why doesn't the MBTA, after constructing the Greenbush line, after taking this initiative now down to the South Shore,
yeah.
and I see they're even talking about going to Plasto, why not extend the train from Worcester west? Buy up the track rights that they just bought between Framingham and Worcester,
yep.
and get a fast train out
yep.
there
yep.
so people in the west can have access to the dynamic economy in the east, and people in the east who want lower housing costs can move farther west.
Couldn't agree with you more. CSX owns that right-of-way. We have been in discussions with them. That is a part of the way forward, which is the transportation plan we propose that has not been funded. The other part of this, Bob, in terms of the Western focus, is you will know from your experience out there that the economic orientation is much more north-south than east-west, meaning people look to Connecticut and New York and to some extent up to Vermont more than they do and to New York, for that matter, New York State. Out the Albany way, more than they do to the east. And so the work on I-91, the viaduct in downtown Springfield, which is falling down and must be saved and redesigned in order for that key artery to work, the train up from New Haven through Massachusetts up the Pioneer Valley and up to Vermont, and even the proposal to revive the Housatonic line, which runs from Pittsfield down to Grand Central Station, were all a part of this plan. Then the last thing I would just say, because Marjorie's holding a piece of paper like she's about to give me a zinger.
no, I'm not.
is that the RTAs, the regional transit authorities, which operate in the Pioneer Valley, and there's obviously one out in Berkshire County as well, they have equipment aging issues as deep as the T. And funding the improvement and modernization of that equipment and enabling them, because they then would have to spend a little less, in many cases a lot less, on maintenance to expand their service is a part of that plan too.
Bob, thank you so much for the call.
Okay, Governor Patrick, ready for my zinger?
Yes.
We're joined by Governor Bob Patrick for a monthly feature, Ask the Governor.
Oh, that's it?
He's taking your calls at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. That conversation continues in just a couple of seconds on 89.7 WGBH.
If paying tuition isn't tough enough for most students, they're forced to pay hundreds of dollars more in fees.
On Campus, the WGBH News Higher Ed Desk with reporter Kirk Carapeza on WGBH Radio.
Many companies stand with their employees in supporting public radio here in New England with matching gifts. Find out if your employer will double or even triple your contribution to WGBH. Ask at work or visit wgbh.org/matching gifts.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Mass Eye and Ear, offering specialty services at more than a dozen locations in the Boston area, and now a new center in the Longwood Medical Area. Visit masseyeandear.org for more information. And Boston University's Executive MBA, Real Classroom, Real Outcomes, online information session September 28th at 9 a.m. You can learn more at bu.edu/embA.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. This is the monthly visit of Governor Deval Patrick to take your calls or questions. We'll get back to your calls at 877-301-8970 in a second. A couple of very quick things, Governor. In the wake of this horror show in Kenya, is there greater security or is anything different at the malls in Massachusetts?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry.
Second, we've asked you a lot of questions in the wake of the marathon about some of the FBI procedures. The Civil Liberties Union in Massachusetts and Florida asked the attorneys general of the two states who had in the case of Florida, an Orlando cop, in the case of Massachusetts, two state troopers, at least in the apartment at some time, around the time that the FBI shot and killed this guy, Ibrahim Todashev, who allegedly was about to admit that he and the older Tsarnaev were responsible for the triple murder in Waltham 2 years earlier on 9/11. Mm-hmm. The Attorney General, Martha Coakley, said, I'm going to reject that request. I am not going to look into it, even though the FBI has not released a report. Do you support the Attorney General's decision?
I do. It's an active investigation. There will be more on that coming out from the FBI in the fullness of time. But there's still some threads that they're pursuing, and I want to respect that.
We're getting a lot of emails about MCAS. Could you give us – we know the results were out in the last couple of days. Give us what you consider to be the highs and the lows, the best news and the worst news.
Best news is that our young people are performing at even higher levels than the high levels at which they have been performing, and that is great. 14 of the – I think it was 34 schools who were originally in the turnaround cohort have emerged from turnaround status. In some cases, gone from level four, which is that turnaround, right up to level one. Orchard Gardens is a school you know I have a soft spot for and have visited a number of times.
Tell people what a turnaround school is.
So a turnaround school is a school where there has been chronic underperformance on MCAS, and there are a couple of other measures as well. And where the through the Achievement Gap Act you get, which we enacted in 2010, I think it was, rules and tools that are now allow for more aggressive intervention to try some things. It's not the same thing everywhere. You got to come up with a plan and what have you. And you have 3 years to work on that. So this was a key measure for that original cohort. So great progress there. The Achievement Gap exists still, but it's closed a little bit. So kids of color and kids who speak English as a second language and with special needs have improved as everyone else has improved and improved a little faster as a group. So that margin is narrowing. At the same time, there are, I think, four or five schools. I don't remember the exact number as I sit here that have gotten worse, at least as with MCAS as a measure. And this is a journey. So I would say on the whole it's very positive news, and there's still more to do.
One last quick thing. I'm not clear. I read the other day that there is about to be this consortium of states exploring online standardized testing potentially to replace MCAS. Can you give us the short version? What's being
contemplated?
So it's called contemplated?
PARC. So here's the one of the odd realities about performance in Massachusetts. We've got all this great stuff happening in all these different schools, district schools, charter schools. We're number one in the nation in student achievement. We have been for each of the last 6 years. And yet for a large proportion of the – and I don't remember the number. I don't think it's a majority, but a large proportion of our high school graduates who then go to state universities and colleges – they're having to take effectively remedial courses. So their college readiness doesn't quite comport with being these high-performing students. And so PARC is about – I think that's the acronym, P-A-R-C-C, I think it is – is a tool that is meant to incorporate MCAS. I'm being more descriptive than, detailed here, but incorporate the objectives of MCAS, but also take it to the level of college readiness to see that we can eliminate that gap as well.
Okay, back to the calls. Governor Deval Patrick at 877-301-8970, Governor.
Okay, Tim is on the road.
Hi there.
Hi, Tim.
Tim.
Thanks for taking my call, and I want to apologize ahead of time for such a mundane question to the governor. I called the show several months ago when the governor was lobbying for the infrastructure fund, and we talk about an issue that exists.
Hey, Tim, the connection is so bad. You have to ask the question concisely, or we're not going to be able to hear you.
Can't hear you, yeah.
So please do it if you can in fairly short order. Sorry.
Okay, hope you can hear me a little better. I'm calling about
Jim, by the way. I have all the time in the world.
I'm calling about the lack of restroom facilities 24/7 at the Mass Hampshire state line. It's especially relevant now that the state is spending almost $300 million for a new bridge, much needed, by the way, about 3 miles south of the state line, yet pull into the welcome to Massachusetts rest area. If you're okay, if they're 9 to 5, that's what it says on the door, and it also gives you directions to get off the highway and go to a gas station.
Hey, Tim, I've got to let you go only because it's horrible sound.
I think Tim called about this before.
He did. He said it's his second call.
And I think Tim also said something about being of a certain time in life where it was important to be. Am I remembering
some people?
This call?
I believe that's right. I think a number
I'm
of people can relate
to
that.
To this.
So what's going on? Are you doing something about it or what?
Well, I think that there are two questions. One was the about the investing in the upgrade and modernization of the bathrooms, and that'll happen in the course of other infrastructure work. But I think the other was the rest areas being at the welcome centers being open
9 to 5
after hours,
only, yeah,
and that's tough because they are inside facilities that have to be staffed, and it's one of the ways where we're not able to support all that staffing. There's a question, the answer to which I don't know, but I will ask, and that is whether there's a way to keep the building open and shut down the stuff that has to be staffed so it's secure, so that people can come in and out. I don't know what the security issues are or the staffing issues are around that, but I can find out.
Back to the calls, Governor Deval Patrick.
Let's see. Joanna is calling from Norwood. Joanna.
Joanna.
I lost Joanna.
We're going to put you on hold. Let's take another one. We'll get back to Joanna in a second, Governor.
Okay. Peter, calling from North Reading. Peter, you there?
Yeah, hello.
Hey.
Hey, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I have a question about the tech tax. Why was there such a big rush to repeal the tech tax, you know what I mean, and not so much on a gas tax or a cigarette tax? You know what I mean? It just seems like once you guys implicated that, all of a sudden, the big business, the tech companies kind of went crazy about it, and now we're talking about pulling it back.
Yeah.
And which, I mean, I'm going to be a speculator here, but, you know, a lot of those companies, big donators to certain political people, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't think that was a motivator, but I think your larger question that, you know, you kind of get the sense that the business people speak up and everybody jumps, and when regular folks complain, maybe not so. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I mean, because that's how it seems to me. I mean, listen, I mean, I'm a blue-collar guy, whatever. Me and my wife, I mean, we're less than 80 grand a year income, whatever. You know, we buy gas, and, you know, we're talking about a legislature. I mean, how many people in the state else actually buy gas? I mean, they got the per diem thing. I mean, you yourself. I mean, when's the last time you pull cash out of your pocket to pay for gas?
Last weekend. Thank you very much. But I get your point. I mean, look, I tried the gas tax a few years ago, Peter, and I had my head handed to me. And I learned when I was out there that at the same time people want better and safer roads, more convenient and more modern transportation, you know, public transportation and what have you, that they are very sensitive to the ways we ask them to pay for that. Certainly, everybody is on board with the idea of squeezing out nonsense in existing spending in order to pay more in the actual upkeep. But the gas tax was one of those things, especially outside of the greater Boston area. And you get out west, Peter, and the energy in opposition to the gas tax is particularly strong because you got farmers, you got people who, you know, they don't have the option, commuters, of jumping on the T, for example. And that is one of the reasons why I did not propose the gas tax in this last time around. And to your point about you and your wife being in the $80,000 annual income range, the reason I proposed the framework I did was that for you and folks in your income range, your total taxes would have remained the same or gone down slightly because the income tax rate would go up, but the sales tax would go down. And the sales tax is one of the most regressive taxes, at least in my view. But yeah, I mean, I understand. I think the I think I said this earlier. The people of the Commonwealth, through their legislature, are going to have to come back to the question of what kind of Commonwealth we want, including and most specifically how we what kind of transportation network we want and what's the fairest way to pay for it.
Well, Peter, thanks. So on that note, Governor, you said that in the context of the tech tax repeal and how does one fill the hole, the $161 million, if, as you say, we need this transportation investment. You went on to say, and we didn't follow up on it, that'll probably be left to my successor after I'm gone, is what's implicit in that response is you have no intention in the next year plus of filing anything that would be a tax increase, a new tax, an expansion of a tax, anything that would be new revenue?
Well, I don't really see. I mean, I got to file a budget in January, but it's not what I anticipate doing. I mean, it was very telling in the meeting that I'm sorry, just lean back in the chair. I realize I may not. Can everyone
okay.
out there hear me?
We're good. Yes.
It was very telling in the meeting where that I mentioned with the tech industry when the leadership, various people were suggesting different things and they kept taking things off the table. So, I don't want to propose anything that is a waste of time from the outset. And I think that the legislature is rightly hesitant to raise taxes. You want a legislature to be hesitant to raise taxes. To think about it and take their time, and that was part of my objection to what they ultimately did, because they proposed it one day and they enacted it 10 days later with no hearing.
Speaking of the legislature, before we get back to the calls, Dan Winslow, whom you said kind things about when he announced his resignation from the legislature the other day, a Republican who is from Norfolk, who is leaving, I think, on the 29th, will bring down to 29 the number of Republicans in the House of Representatives. Bob Hedlund, a state senator, indicated to Marjorie and me the other day that he will leave, quote, sooner rather than later, which
really
means we'll be down to potentially two Republicans in the Senate. As good and loyal a Democrat as you are, on that moment when Bob Hedlund leaves, I'll do the math, that's going to be 169 Democrats and 31 Republicans. Is that good for small d democracy, such an imbalance
well,
in two-party rule?
So, I have – first of all, we need a strong Republican Party. We need a loyal opposition. We do not need obstructionists and radicals, frankly, in either party. And that's what I was getting at in terms of the national Republican Party. Marjorie, in the quote you threw in my face a minute
leading
ago,
us over the cliff.
Right. But I think I've told you before, the dynamic, as I experience it on Beacon Hill, is not Republican-Democrat. It's insider-outsider. We have Democrats, God love them, in our legislature who in other states would be Republicans. We have a whole range of philosophies and I think probably like a lot of legislative bodies, relationships have a whole lot to do with things moving. And it's not all about the merits. It's also about the merits, but it's other stuff too. And I think that the Speaker and the Minority Leader on the House side and the Senate President and the Minority Leader on the Senate side have a really great working relationship. They don't They help each other as they can, and when they have a principal difference, they have a principal difference.
Back to the calls, Governor DeVal Patrick, 877-301-8970.
Let's see who is calling. Bill is on the road. Bill,
welcome, Bill.
Good afternoon.
That's a good connection. I was afraid we were going to get another one of those choppy.
Governor.
I pulled over, Governor.
There you go.
So my question is, I'm a small businessman. I have 15 employees in my company.
Yep.
And healthcare is a huge expense to me. Out of the 15, we have 6 that are on healthcare, and the rest are not, including myself.
On your own health care, your company's health care plan?
Yes, my company's health care plan. And I'm not on it. I own the company, but my wife's a school teacher in Quincy, and I'm on her health care because it's a tremendous savings for me.
Yes.
It's a huge expense for me. It's hindering me from growing because I can't add another body because, you know, someone's husband just lost their job. Her family has to come on. My expense goes up again another $10,000 a year for that. So, you know, and that's part of doing business, and I get it. I'm not complaining about it. I'm just saying, what options does a small business like me have to take my 5 employees or 6 employees who are going to be on it and get with a larger group of other people to help, like you said, help defray the cost so I can try to drive costs out and give them what they want.
Yep.
People aren't leaving my health plan to go on their husbands or wives because I'm offering something better than their husband or wife gets. So I'm incurring more people. I'm getting more people to come to it, and that's not what I want.
Yeah.
I don't want to discourage them coming, but I want to try to keep my expenses down.
Sure you do.
It's going to cost me $60,000 to $70,000 this year, and that's a body.
So, Bill, I'm glad you asked the question for a couple reasons. It gives me a chance to make a couple points. And if you would please not hang up, I just want to get a telephone number where we can follow up because there's some specific help they can give you at the connector.
So stay on the line when the governor's finished responding, Bill, please. Go ahead, Governor.
Just 2 things I want to say. First of all, we enacted some legislation a couple of years ago that permitted through some of the small business associations, small businesses to come together to aggregate so they could have buying power comparable to the buying power that big businesses have, which is considerable. And Bill, if you stay on the line, we'll get you some information about that because it may be helpful to you. The other thing is a culture change that we need, I think, in Massachusetts and in this country, and that's this whole idea of shopping to save. What I hear from small businesses in particular is that they have this annual merry-go-round where they get their premium increase and they immediately start the conversation about how to buy or provide less insurance for the same price, meaning, you know, a bigger deductible, a change in the copay or something like that, to manage their own costs, rather than seeing what else is offered by other companies similar coverage at the same or a lower price. And because there is a lot more information available up on the web, thanks to Obamacare, by the way. This is a lot easier to do starting the 1st of October and getting easier right through next year. So, Bill, if you will stay on, we'll have somebody follow up with you and show you what tools are available and what tools and alert you to what tools will be available over the coming weeks and months.
Governor, before we continue with the calls, you know, Marjorie has read, I think, 2 times now your comments from Jersey yesterday, a band of radicals who want to drag the country and its economy over a cliff, describing some in Washington. We want you to listen to something else that was said in Washington this week, and I know Marjorie wants to ask you something. Here it is.
Not right now, because he did promise us we'd give him 2 terms, and then he'd go back to private life. But I'm not ruling it out. I mean, I think it would be really, really hard to have a father who's the president. But my governor is kind of awesome, and I really love him.
Is that another radical who wants to drag the country down? Who is that? Obviously some crazy. Who is that?
That's our youngest daughter, Catherine. You watch what you say.
Exactly. And what was she talking about, Governor Patrick?
We were together at an event in Washington where we were interviewed by an anchor from MSNBC. And the question, totally off topic, was, am I going to run for president? And she answered.
And she said she wasn't ruling it out.
Yes.
Are you?
Look, I'm not going to – maybe – but listen, I'm not making any news. I'm saying the same thing I've ever always said. I am going to finish the job I have, and I am loving it. And when I finish the job I have, I am going to find a job in the private sector. And I hope there will come a time, sometime later in life, when I have something else I can contribute to public life. And when that time comes, we'll see.
So, but Governor, I interviewed John Walsh the other day, the outgoing chair of the Democratic State Committee, who obviously was intimately involved in your campaigns and generally is seen as one of the, by Republicans and Democrats, as one of the great political operatives in Massachusetts.
He is.
I knew that he was going to be doing some work for your political action committee. Mm-hmm. What I did not know till the other day is that he was doing it full time. I thought he was going back to his insurance company. Mm-hmm. What kind of political action committee has a full-time director who's one of the most sophisticated political operatives for a guy who intends to go back to the private sector and may or may not get involved in politics again?
You know, Jim, I still have a voice. I'm still involved. I'm still interested in candidates and campaigns that are about conviction politics and governing for the long term instead of just the next election cycle. I think that is a change we brought to the governor's office and to politics here, and frankly, the whole emphasis on the grassroots is something that we help to revive here in Massachusetts. And so I'm involved, and I want to be involved in that nationally, and I will be right through to the end of my time as governor.
You know, one more question about your daughter. During the same event where you were interviewed by the host from MSNBC, your daughter talked about announcing that she was gay to her mom and dad. And she says she made the announcement, and then her father says to her, "So, do you want ham or tuna on your sandwich?" I mean, that's a pretty momentous moment. Is that really true? Is that what you said?
Do you want ham or tuna? We were out in Western Massachusetts. We were getting lunch ready for the family, and mm-hmm. And she kept saying, "You know, I have something I want to say to you. I want to say, and I need you and mom in the same place." And she came into the kitchen. We were gathering stuff, and people were sitting out. We're outside, and I actually don't remember saying that. I thought I said, "Well, you grab the mayonnaise and let's go out."
But, a variation on a theme.
Okay.
Governor, we have time
for... You know, you love your kids. You love your kids.
Yeah.
We have a grandchild now, and you know, instantly and magically, we are totally in love with this kid. And he's going to have his ups and downs and his ins and outs, and he's going to make his mom and dad crazy and probably cause us worry, but you have to love him. And the fact that you have to is actually turns out to be pretty easy.
You know, Governor, we're usually here at noon when we don't have a hard, as it's called, out time. We have a minute and a half, so let's try to squeeze in one call and an answer if we can.
Okay.
Governor DeVal Patrick.
Okay, Brian is calling from Southbridge. Brian, you there?
Got to be brief, Brian.
Yep. I've never been involved in politics until up recently. Me neither. Well, you did a good job when I was serving in the National Guard, so I'll give you credit for that.
Thank you.
But, my current job now, I drive overnights on a standard route, and everybody's talking about the transportation tax and everything like that. And I've been noticing a lot of repairs on bridges.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll watch it for weeks, and it seems like it's done. And all of a sudden, the barriers are back up, and they're digging up whatever they just fixed again. And I was just wondering, what's the oversight? I don't see Mass DOT out there. It seems like it's all subcontracted. And I'm just worried about that going up for this.
Brian, we have to let the governor answer. Yeah, please.
Well, really quickly, most of the construction done in Massachusetts is done privately. And some of – I don't know what projects in particular you've seen, but some of it will have to do with when the utilities are available to come back and do their part of the project. And coordinating that has been a perennial challenge.
Now, by the way, as the governor always says at this point, I'll preempt him. Every email that was sent
cover a topic. Sorry, you guys.
Will be forwarded to his office. Everybody in line, stay on. We'll take your phone number and the governor's office will be back in touch. Governor, it's great to see you.
We'll see you next month.
Thank you so much for your time.
And again, I'm sorry we didn't get to all the emails, but Governor DeVal Patrick does join us every month for Ask the Governor. And thank you again for being here with us. Thank you guys for listening. Tune in tomorrow for another edition of I was going to say the Egan and Browdy Show, but it's not
that anymore.
No, that
was a long time ago,
Margaret. It is, in fact, Boston Public Radio, and we are a production of WGBH Radio. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Governor, for being with us.
Great to be with you.
And thank you guys for tuning in. See you tomorrow.